I think all of us would acknowledge that there recently has been a lot more momentum behind health care reform in the United States. Massachusetts enacted a state-level plan. Some of us have concerns about how it's being implemented, but nonetheless, it is out there and providing some opportunity to see how it's working. California, of course, has been debating a plan. Governor Schwarzenegger had his own plan. The legislature had some other ideas, and we'll see if they can come together. New Mexico and Colorado are among the states that have had governor's level task forces and panel to try to figure out what to do, and there are many other states in this kind of stage of exploration, including New York, my home state. And of course, all the major presidential candidates have announced plans, some more comprehensive than others, for health care reform. Women's health advocates, though, by and large, have not been actively participating in the debate, with some exceptions. The women in California have been great and have really tried hard to get women's health concerns forward. But the problem is that many of us are unfamiliar with the terms and concepts of healthcare reform, and we're not really sure how to evaluate the competing proposals. It's for that reason that my organization has partnered with Billy's Avery Institute and Amy's National Women's Health Network to sponsor a series of webinars that have been helping to inform women about these terms and concepts so we're ready to get into the debate. And the next one is on November 15th. I'll talk a little bit more about it later. I want to stress for this audience the risks of not getting engaged in this debate. It's true that all of us as reproductive health advocates have a lot on our plate, not to mention the Supreme Court decision and its aftermath and many other important issues, but we've got to get this onto our agendas. If we don't, our concerns may not be addressed. Key players, such as the insurance companies and employers, are not really that sympathetic to our concerns most of the time. And in fact, opponents of women's reproductive health care are already powerful players in national health care reform. And that is what the majority of my talk is going to be about this morning. Here are some of the organizations that are already extremely active on healthcare reform nationally. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Catholic Health Association, the National Association of Evangelicals, the National Right to Life Association, and some of the other groups that I'm sure are very familiar to many of you in the audience. Let me give you an example of the notions about healthcare reform from some of these groups. The Conference of Catholic Bishops has announced a series of criteria for healthcare reform, and of course many of them are things we would agree with, like making healthcare available for the poor. We care about that, right? But they also have a key criteria of respect for life. And in particular, they are very strongly asserting that a core benefits package that would be offered under healthcare reform should not include, quote, morally objectionable procedures such as abortion and euthanasia. Including these would be morally wrong and, here comes the threat, politically disastrous, destroying any chance of broad support for reform. So they're laying down the line there. They're saying if you include these services, we're going to disrupt your chances for broad support. Catholic Health Association, this is the organization that represents Catholic hospitals, nursing homes, and health clinics. The president, Sister Carol Keehan, has been named the most powerful person in healthcare this year by Modern Healthcare Magazine. And I would have to say there's some good things about that because I know Sister Carol and she is a tremendous advocate for the poor and services for low-income people. But she is also guided by Catholic doctrine and what the bishops have to say. The Catholic Health Association has launched a campaign called Covering a Nation, Our Vision for U.S. Healthcare. And here is one of the key principles. They want respect for the role of religiously affiliated healthcare religiously affiliated healthcare organizations. And in particular, two things: protect the free exercise of ethical and religious beliefs, ensure that providers of healthcare services are not required to perform acts or procedures that infringe on their religious beliefs. So, what are we talking about here? Abortion, the emergency contraception pills, contraception, that, in their view, should not be included in any benefits package of healthcare reform. And, I should say, reject public financing for such procedures. So what are we talking about there? We're really talking about the Hyde Amendment transferred into national health insurance. How influential is the Catholic Health Association? Well, they are one of the partners in this group called the Healthcare Coalition for the Uninsured. And look at some of the other organizations that they are partnering with, including our own. And I have had some private discussions with Dr. Benjamin about this, which I'm not able to share, but he's certainly aware of our section's concerns about this. Another of the organizations very active is the National Association of Evangelicals. Until recently, it was headed by Ted Haggard. You may remember him. He was forced out in a sex scandal. Look at some of the denominations that are included here: Salvation Army, the Baptist General Conference, Assemblies of God, which I believe was the denomination that Attorney General Ashcroft belongs to. They include the Christian Medical and Dental Society, the Christian Broadcasting Network. They have a lot of power and influence. And here are their principles. Abortion is not health care. Any health plan which includes coverage for elective abortion should be rejected. And not just abortion services, but abortion referral, payment for abortion, or the training of medical personnel for abortion practices. So they've thought this through pretty thoroughly. I did want to point out the third bullet point down there, which is of interest and presents some opportunities for us to build partnership with other organizations. They think that people who have smoked or abused drugs or alcohol, have been overeating, have been promiscuous, are responsible for their own health problems and should have to pay for it.
All of us.
All of us, yeah. National Right to Life Organization. They have a new proposal for state-based health reform, and they are focusing in a very, what's kind of a curious way to go at it, but it has the same effect. They're upset with what they call rationing of health care, which they equate with involuntary euthanasia. So, for example, they refer to Hillary Clinton's plan of the earlier version, not the new one. I'm not sure what they think about the new one, as the health care rationing plan of 1993 to 94. And basically, they're concerned about anything in a healthcare plan that could lead to the death of an individual, including some things we would agree with, you know, that people shouldn't be denied access to comprehensive medical care because that could lead to a serious illness or death. Concerned Women for America, one of my favorite groups. This is Beverly LaHaye, or as she calls herself, Mrs. Beverly LaHaye. She is the wife of Tim LaHaye, who is the author of the best-selling Left Behind books. If you haven't read those yet, you should. They're all about the rapture and how the correct people in society will be taken up to heaven and the rest of us will be left behind.
You only have to read one.
Right. I'll have to read a part of one.
Well, believe me, everybody in this room would be left behind. They describe themselves, and I think many of us in this room will find this interesting, as the nation's largest public policy women's organization. And their goal is to bring biblical principles to all level of public policy. So I've been following their recent activities, especially around SCHIP, the State Children's Health Insurance Program. And here are some of the things that they've been saying. And you might notice that the first one might sound kind of familiar. They're upset that SCHIP may be a stepping stone to universal health insurance. Of course, I would love it if that were the case. But this is many of the concerns that we've heard from the conservative Republicans and even from the president. This is what they're talking about. They're also upset with the use of SCHIP funds for adults in some states. And as you have probably noticed, adults are being phased out in the revised SCHIP plan. And they've got a lot of concerns about the use of grant money, SCHIP money, for these services. Of course, some of them are not actually covered by SCHIP, but that doesn't seem to make the difference. So, what's the current strategy of our progressive partners in many of the big healthcare organizations like Families USA, for example? Well, they have decided among themselves to table any discussion of which services should be covered. And this is because they want to avoid arguments over things like abortion at this stage of the process. And not just abortion, but also issues like should there be an individual mandate, they're trying to stay out of the details. And I can understand that as a strategy. Their advice to us is just be quiet now, play nice, and once there is an agreement that everybody deserves coverage, well, then the benefit packages will fall into place. But where does that leave us? Our issues are not on the table. We're being advised to hold back like good girls and don't say anything until we get to universal coverage. But in the meantime, I showed you, the Catholic Health Association is at the table, and there are no women's health organizations there. So how can we be sure our concerns will be remembered and addressed? Well, here's my idea of a strategy, and I think we're kind of working with this in the partnership of Merger Watch, National Women's Health Network, and Avery Institute. I think first we've got to demonstrate that women are important in this conversation. We are 80% of the single issue health care voters in this country. And I just got that statistic from Celinda Lake the other day at a presentation. We all know we're the prime purchasers and arrangers of health care for our families, not just for us, but for our kids, for our elderly parents, for our husbands. And there's a particular interest in the health care reform community about small businesses. How are we going to help small businesses be able to give health insurance to their employers? And it turns out, again from Celinda Lake, that women owners of small businesses are the most interested in trying to figure out how to get health insurance for their employees. So here's the strategy that I would suggest. We've got to build a broad-based women's health coalition that includes everybody in this room and addresses the concerns of both uninsured and insured women. We need to cite problems that we've been hearing about. The premiums are too costly, the deductibles are too high, the co-pays, I can't afford them, I can't take my kids to the doctor. We have to fight against exclusion of women for coverage because of pre-existing conditions such as pregnancy and breast cancer. This issue of pre-existing conditions is very, very high on the agenda of folks who are concerned about health care in the electoral campaign. And then we have to advocate for a comprehensive array of women's health services. Yes, reproductive health care, but also the option to use midwives, improved breast cancer detection and treatment, primary care, improved home care for the elderly and disabled, and respect for end-of-life choices. It's only when we get a broad movement together with a lot of power behind us that we'll be able to get a place at the table. And once we can do that, we can start to build mutual respect and partnerships with these mainstream health organizations. We have to bring our voting power to the table. We need to exercise women's influence in favor of quality, affordable health coverage that works for us and our families. Make sure no services are excluded from benefit packages at the beginning, the middle, or the end of the process, and try to have a voice in the design of these benefit packages. There's a lot of potential benefits to reproductive health advocates of getting involved in this. I believe that health reform can be a vehicle for addressing gaps in women's health coverage. I believe reproductive health services could be mainstreamed into healthcare reform rather than being marginalized as lifestyle issues or abortion rights issues. I believe we have an opportunity to promote a holistic women's health agenda that addresses care across the lifespan. And that is what we were trying to do with a new initiative for which we've received startup funding from the Ford Foundation. It's called Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need. Here are some of the objectives of this initiative. And this is our logo, care of Billie Avery and her graphic artist. And you will be hearing more about this shortly. But I really want to urge you to think about this strategy because we've got to find a way to get ourselves at the table. Thank you. And next will be Amy Alina.
Thanks, Lois. I don't have slides, so you only get to look at me. But my talk is going to be is based on very preliminary findings from a report that the National Women's Health Network is going to be putting out on looking at state healthcare reform initiatives and how they are affecting women's health and how they're dealing with women's health issues as they go forward. So it's preliminary for two reasons. One is that we're still doing the research for the report. We haven't produced it yet. And the other reason it's preliminary is that many of these initiatives are very new. We look at Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, and the newest, the reform that's going forward in the city of San Francisco. And the San Francisco initiative is literally, I think, about a month old. So we can talk about what's happened so far, and I think it's important for us to be watching as these plans evolve, but we also need to recognize that things are still changing, still happening and still changing. So we're assessing these efforts based on their ability to address the barriers that women face to obtaining insurance and accessing needed care, and also on ultimately on their ability to achieve and maintain healthy lives. And we're looking at things like some of the issues that Lois highlighted in terms of inclusion of comprehensive reproductive health services, since that's been so controversial historically in any public health care program. We're looking at some of the problems that we see in the current broken system and seeing how these new initiatives will address them, things like ensuring a range of birthing options for women. And we're also looking at, those are issues that affect all women, regardless of what community we're a part of, regardless of income. These are problems that we face in the healthcare system today and that we don't want to face in a system that we work to fix. But then we're also going to specifically look at how responsive these reforms are and these new plans are to the needs of women who have historically faced the greatest barriers in accessing healthcare. So that includes immigrant women, women with disabilities, and also LGBTQ women. So that's what our report is looking at. Before I dive into the findings, I wanted to give a little bit of background on why health insurance is a women's problem. And Lois talked about, kind of what the risks are to not getting involved. I want to even back up a step from there and say some things that some of you are probably pretty familiar with, but just in the healthcare reform debate, people often talk about who's got skin in the game, who's affected. I want to talk about why this matters to women. you know, we're actually slightly less likely than men to be uninsured. So why healthcare reform as a women's issue? Why isn't it just a healthcare issue? But even though we're slightly less likely to be uninsured, we are significantly more likely to be reliant on public health insurance. And so we're talking about Medicaid, Medicare. 70% of the adult Medicaid population is women. And, you know, this is a key important source of health insurance for women, but it's got its limitations. Lois referred to the Hyde Amendment earlier, you know, the exclusion of coverage that women need from Medicaid is a really serious problem with the Medicaid program, and it's one that has been in place for 30 years, and we just take it for granted in many cases. But as we look at fixing the problems with our current system, we need to be sure that we don't perpetuate the same problems. So examining what's gone wrong with what we have is a piece of moving forward. And then stepping back from the public insurance programs, we look at private health insurance, and we see even women who have private health insurance, who are sort of in the lucky group today, face a lot of problems with getting health care. And you know, women are more likely to be insured as dependents than men, less likely to have jobs that offer them health insurance and therefore have to get it through a spouse, which means that we're vulnerable to losing our insurance when we divorce or are widowed. We work more often than men in part-time jobs or low-wage jobs, which don't offer us health care benefits. And small businesses employ a lot of women, and Lois made reference to this earlier. Small businesses are less likely to offer health benefits to their employees, less likely to be able to afford to offer health benefits to their employees, and also more likely to drop that benefit as premiums rise. So the current system, the problems with the current system, and as we're seeing the current system collapsing on itself, that's having a bigger impact on women most immediately. The final kind of background point I wanted to make is looking at who is uninsured, going back to the uninsured, because even though we are, as I said, slightly less likely to be uninsured, I think it's also important to consider who is uninsured. If you look at women who are at greatest risk for being uninsured, we're talking about women who aren't born in this country, Latinas, and obviously low-income women. So while we may be less likely to be in that group, those of us who are in that group are people who are least likely to have the tools to fight for and influence change. So we've got a big stake in healthcare reform. It needs to be a high priority of our community to fix this broken system. And that's the background that shapes the National Women's Health Network's commitment to working for healthcare reform. We also have a pretty strong belief and desire to make sure that as we fix the system, we don't just end up with the same problems replicated. So we're working for improved access, and we're working for improved quality. And with that, we decided to take a look at what's happening in Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, and San Francisco. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about each of those reform initiatives to kind of give you a sense of how those states and that city, are approaching the effort, and then talk about some specific women's healthcare issues in those cities. As I said, these are preliminary findings. We're still in the process of doing our research, and if any of you are from those states or from San Francisco and you have something to add, I hope you'll do that in the Q&A and discussion part. First of all, because it'll be to the benefit of everyone here, but secretly because I can take notes and use it as we go forward with our report. So I'm going to start with Maine. You know, policymakers in a lot of states have been debating and discussing this issue, but Maine was the first state to pass legislation that was really going to try to get to universal coverage. And they did it in 2003 when they implemented the DiRigo Health Reform Act, which is aimed at providing access to every citizen by 2009. In addition to providing access to every citizen, they're also trying to contain the healthcare, you know, the rising healthcare costs and do some improvement on quality of care. DiRigo Choice provides discounted health insurance on a voluntary basis to Maine businesses that have 50 or fewer employees, to people who are self-employed, and to individuals who don't have health insurance through some other source. It operates on a sliding scale, and if you enroll in it, you get a comprehensive policy from what was, at the time that the program was started, Maine's largest insurer, Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and then pay what you can afford according to an income index. And the difference on this sliding scale is covered by the state. So that's kind of the basic operations of the plan. As of July of this year, there were about 14,400 Mainers covered by the program. So in terms of women's health care, DiRigo provides comprehensive reproductive health coverage, including abortion, family planning, routine gynecology, prenatal and maternity care. The state already had a contraceptive equity policy in place, and so that was an important piece of shaping how the plan went forward. The inclusion of abortion is a really interesting note there, because what happened is that they did their reform based on an insurance model, and private health insurance very often does include abortion coverage. And so when they went to the health insurers and said, what's the plan going to look like, it was in there. Maine is not a state that has Medicaid coverage for abortion. So you have this odd there, where if you're a woman who gets your health insurance through Medicaid in Maine, you don't have abortion coverage. If you are equally poor as the women who are on Medicaid, but you're not qualified for Medicaid by the categorical qualifications, you may be getting very likely be getting your health care through the state plan, which currently does include abortion coverage. So it's an odd split. Maine has been, the advocates in Maine have been trying to use this to point out how unfair it is to have the state Medicaid program not cover abortion. They haven't gotten that legislative change made yet, but they're working on it, and certainly we hope it'll go in that direction rather than the other. You know, we'd like to see it equal out to the benefit of women having the coverage we need. Pregnancy care, birthing are covered, midwifery services are included, and Maine is a state with a real commitment to midwifery care. There are access problems there, as many places, with birthing options, but from a policy perspective, the pieces are in place. Maine also has parity for mental health care, so mental health coverage was included equally in the plan, but again, access is a big problem, especially when you look at something like substance abuse problems, substance abuse treatment programs. There are, you know, horrible, there just are not enough places in the programs, and people don't have access to the care they need, even though, as I said, with the birthing options, the policy planks are in place. They didn't make any special special provisions in the plan for immigrant women, and we're still, this is one of the issues that we're still kind of trying to delve into. Maine doesn't have as big an immigrant women population as many other states, like, say, California, but that there are not no immigrant women there, and we're trying to figure out what people can tell us who are in the state and working with immigrants about how the plan is playing out for them. And another issue that was raised by advocates that's a women-specific concern and relates just to the, I think, we didn't hear it from advocates in other states, but it's important to think about as we look at the other states, is that the program has a real benefit to women who are in abusive relationships, because the advocates in Maine have said that lack of affordable health insurance has been a barrier for women who are considering leaving abusive relationships. And creating another path for getting health care coverage has been a real benefit in that community. The issues that Maine is facing right now have a lot to do with financing. The most of the opposition to the plan right now is focused on the funding mechanism. There's a savings offset payment that is an ongoing assessment on insurance companies, and that's one of the important funding streams for the program, how they're going to pay for health insurance for people who didn't have it previously. And at the time that the plan was devised, the business community, including the insurance community, was really behind it. And as the implementation has played out, some of that support has split off. So the Maine Chamber of Commerce and the Maine Association of Health Plans have actually brought a legal action against the state, arguing that the way the savings offset payment is calculated is improper. So they're facing some challenges in terms of financing. And right now, as a result of that challenge, the enrollment is capped. So I mentioned 14,400 as of July. That's not all of the people who need access through this program yet. You know, they've been scaling up their enrollment, but they've had to cap it because they can only afford to provide care to people who don't need financial assistance right now. That's not going to accomplish their goal of insuring everyone in the state by 2009. So it's something we need to keep watching. So advocates have told us that one of the really important lessons they've learned is that you need to pay attention to who's going to, especially if you go with an insurance model the way they did, which many of the states that are doing reforms are doing, you need to pay attention to who's going to market the program. What Maine did is a public-private partnership. It was primarily marketed by private insurance brokers. And the advocates say that, you know, they have a disincentive to market it because it competes with their other products. So that's been an issue, and they really feel like going back, they would have liked to see the state taking on the responsibility for marketing. They think that's part of the reason enrollment numbers are lower than they had anticipated they would be. They also, looking at the problems they're having with the financing, have said that it's important to use multiple funding streams to finance the program. And then turning to lessons that relate specifically to the women's health concerns, the advocates in Maine have said that they feel like the fact that they had a contraceptive equity policy in place in the state to start was really key, and that the what was included in private health insurance ended up being the starting point. And so looking at what you've already got and making sure you can maintain that as you go into a healthcare reform effort is very important. And then it's not over till it's implemented. And even then, it's not over. The work doesn't stop just because you have your great victory of a legislature enacting health care reform. So the ongoing work in Maine to making sure that they can keep this program that they've put in place is turning out to be as big a battle as the battle to get it. So as big as we think it is to work for national health care reform or health care reform in any of the states where you all are working, that won't be the end of the fight. And the final point they've made is, you know, to get and keep business community support, advocates need to figure out how to get employers invested and how to keep them invested as it goes forward. Thanks. Okay, Massachusetts. Maine broke ground by being the first state to enact comprehensive health care reform in 2003. But Massachusetts was another first, and we've been seeing a lot of attention to Massachusetts in the last year or so. April 2006 is when Massachusetts enacted its health care reform plan, and it was the first to try to provide universal access to health care by mandating that residents purchase health insurance. So it's a concept of shared responsibility there. People, business, and government all have a responsibility for getting everybody covered. And to give you a little bit less background on what how Massachusetts worked, other than to say it's this individual mandate, because I think you've probably had more of a chance to hear about it than you did about Maine. When we look at coverage for women's health care in Massachusetts, what we hear from the advocates is that their women's health advocates weren't so much a part of the broad coalition of healthcare and consumer groups that were involved in the development of the reform plan. But as the reforms got implemented, as they figured out what the benefits were going to look like, reproductive health advocates in particular were really instrumental in securing two pieces, which were contraceptive coverage and abortion. And as I mentioned with Maine a minute ago, Massachusetts also had an existing contraceptive equity law that mandated that insurance companies offer prescription coverage also cover prescription contraceptives. And so advocates wanted to make sure that those mandates were protected in the healthcare reform debate, but they ran up against a problem that Lois mentioned in her talk, which is that part of one of the principles that was agreed on by the healthcare reform coalition was to kind of turn attention away from mandates for specific services and work for the principle of getting everybody covered rather than focusing on specific services. So you were up against some tension between advocates saying these particular services that we're concerned about and then we know get targeted for exclusion need to be in there, we need a commitment that they're going to be in there, versus advocates who were saying, we're just concerned with getting everybody access to some kind of health care, and we'll take care of it later. And that was a tension, but there didn't end up being so much controversy over contraception because it was something people were used to having in health insurance there. And the controversy ended up just being, are we going to mandate specific services? The Connector Board in Massachusetts is the board that determines what has to be included in a basic health insurance package. And they did end up saying contraception should be in there, and they did end up saying abortion should be in there, although they really shied away from the language of mandates. Massachusetts also provides parity for mental health services, but again, access is a problem. Finding an appropriate available provider who accepts insurance of any kind, let alone Medicaid, is a barrier. One of the advocates said, we're good at covering it, but we're not good at delivering it. So those are the kinds of implementation issues that need to be looked at pretty carefully. You Massachusetts is maybe a little bit behind Maine in terms of timing, and so they're still looking at enrollment. It's one of the things they're monitoring, who is and who isn't signing up, whether the there are barriers that are impeding enrollment, and then as people enroll, are they actually able to get the services that are promised? Thank you. Quickly, lessons from Massachusetts. Again, as with Maine, building on existing protections and being aware of vulnerabilities that stem from protections that aren't in place, building real partnerships. And then this is one thing we heard from the advocates. Don't wait for an invitation to join the group. Don't wait for an invitation to join the party. Don't assume that you're going to be formally invited into the process. You may need to go forward and say, we need to be at this table. And in some ways, you can maybe able to forge a better working relationship if you approach it that way, because you are coming with something that you really want to get done. Okay. I'm going to do Vermont really quickly. Vermont's a little different. They are not calling they're not naming this an effort to get to universal health care. They're trying to cover uninsured Vermonters who don't qualify for other state programs. The program there is called Catamount Health. It's financed by a Medicaid waiver that was negotiated with the federal government, by a tobacco excise tax, and by some legislative appropriations and employer assessments. Residents who are 18 and older are eligible if they're uninsured or have insurance that only provides hospital care or doctor's visits, but not both, and if they've not had health insurance for the past 12 months. And that's one of the issues that Vermont is struggling with now, is that you have to be uninsured for 12 months before you're eligible is creating some problems for them. Coverage for women's health care there weren't actually any, again, it's an insurance model. There were no attempts made to exclude abortion or contraceptive coverage, but here access to abortion services is a major, major problem. And especially after 15 weeks, most Vermont women who need abortions at 16 weeks or later have to go out of state. And it seems like Catamount doesn't cover it if you go out of state. So even if you might have coverage, if you were in that early phase, you're not going to have it later. There's a recent development that that's about pregnancy care that is a pretty big concern. But it's again, this is one of those things that's really still playing out. So people don't know what's going to happen. But initially, advocates were promised that Vermont would follow federal regulations that say pregnancy can't be considered a pre-existing condition. You need to be able to get your pregnancy care covered. But during the implementation phase, the state health care administration insurance companies seem to be wavering on that. And that's a thing that has advocates very agitated right now. So something that they're looking to shore up with the legislature. They also have a residency requirement for enrolling in Catamount. So obviously that has an impact on some immigrants. Their lessons, real tension between the fighting for specific services versus the message of getting everybody covered, and how to negotiate that, and how to build on what you have, not lose the coverage that exists beforehand, and try to use that as an argument rather than focusing and saying, we need to get contraception, we need to get abortion, we need to get birthing options, to say, this is what we already have in the system that everyone agrees needs to be improved. So let's not lose that. That's the way they talked about negotiating that tension. I'm out of time, so I'm trying to figure out what to do about San Francisco. Maybe I'll just say San Francisco is doing something really different. Obviously, it's not a statewide program, but what they've done is not an insurance model. It's guaranteeing access to care, and it's giving everybody a medical home to go to, which is trying through that, they're trying to focus on having better coordinated care. It does include access. I'm just looking for my list of what's included to make sure that I tell you the right things. But includes everything that we were asking about specifically in terms of comprehensive reproductive health services and mental health parity. But as I said, it's so new. I think advocates really do still need to be in a monitoring role and seeing how it all plays out. It's San Francisco, after all. But the tensions in delivering health care come up around financing and come up around ensuring access. I was in a session yesterday where the policy of using medical homes, while it's great for coordinated care and great for giving people, helping people to build a sustained relationship with a provider, a disability health rights activist was pointing out that using medical homes doesn't necessarily work very well for people who have specialized medical needs. So you've got medical homes in community health clinics and smaller healthcare facilities that are physically inaccessible to people in wheelchairs, that don't have the special equipment necessary for giving women with disabilities a good gynecological exam. And you have medical homes that may not have healthcare providers with the training needed to provide care to women with disabilities. So that's going to be an issue to watch as things go forward in San Francisco. I'm going to stop there, but I hope we'll have time to discuss it because I'm stopping close on time.
Thank you, Amy. And next we will have Billy Avery, founder of the National Black Women's Health Imperative and the Avery Institute for Social Change.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
How y'all doing? You know, I look out and the room is almost full because we did a similar kind of workshop presentation like this last year, and we had just a handful of people. So it reminded me of when I started the Black Women's Health Project. I was in Gainesville, Florida. The first meeting I had, one person came. And so then about a month later, I had another meeting and two people came. And so I was talking to my mother. I talked to my mother every day on the phone. And I said, I don't know if I can really do this because I had one person come the second, that first time and two people came the second time. She said, well, you doubled. So I'm feeling like we doubled. So we ready to move. We got almost every chair is filled. That's pretty good. So we just had a wonderful, I can't go into this without just mentioning a little bit about last evening. Last evening we celebrated Cindy's 20th year of being the executive director at the National Women's Health Network. And we were in the room with the Women's Health Movement Greatness. Carol Downer was there, who, I don't know if you all know who Carol Downer was, but she was a woman who was a Girl Scout leader. She went to her gynecologist to get a pap smear, and she asked him what was he looking at, and he told it was none of her business. And when he went out the room, she stole his speculum and put it in her pocketbook, and she went home, got out her speculum, a flashlight, and a mirror, and looked at her cervix, and the women's health movement was born. We were in the room with Carol last night, and with Barbara Seaman, who wrote one of the first books about the doctor's case against the pill, the birth control pill. Cheryl Ruzek, who's written history. I mean, it was like, oh my God, it was like the Academy Awards of women's health activists. So I come with a lot of that energy from locking arms with these sisters. As you might figure out, I come out of the women's health movement that was organized in the late 60s and the 70s, and it was based on us being willing to do consciousness raising. That is to sit and talk with each other honestly, realistically, about our lives, about what was happening in our lives, and in that way, we not only learned about ourselves, we learned about others, and we learned about issues. We also place values on women's lived experiences. So nobody really valued what we had to say. We were either accused of complaining or bitching and moaning or whatever, but we put value on what women are saying. We also learn that we have to pay attention, listen to our bodies, to value what we feel, to know intrinsically what we need, and to put it out there. We also learn the concept of mutual respect for each other, for all in all of our ethnic diversity and all of our sexual orientations and everything. Everybody's thinking is valued. Now, I tell you that because these are principles that I think we need to utilize in order to get involved in healthcare reform. This stuff is hard. This is real hard. And it tends to be boring. It tends to, you gotta spice it up. You know, you really do. You have to put your best creative thinking on. But know that you are talking to people who are affected. You know, one of the things I get asked all the time is, how can I go out into the black community and talk about abortion? Well, I know that 50% of the women in the room have had abortion. And so I'm talking to them. I'm talking to what's happening. So know that people here know about health care, that we all, you know, you lose your job, you know, you get whatever can happen, all of these grants can disappear, all the state money can disappear, all this stuff can fall on hard times, and people's lives can change in a flash. So really, this is a struggle for all of us. None of us is above this, no matter unless you are a quadrillionaire who can pay for health care. It's very expensive. It's real expensive. So one of the things I feel that we have to do is to come together across all of our lines, all of our diversities, and start out with a diverse table. Don't go and try to add people on at the end. Or if you're going to add them on by the second meeting. But when you do your thinking, you start and you look and you want to have inclusion, because that is the way that we build a viable movement. That's the very first thing we have to do. Now, some of the other strategies is create a place where people are comfortable to feel that their opinions will be voiced. Not everybody is going to feel the same about the same thing. That would be the most boring thing. You know, we would then have problems because we'd all be going crazy because there was a bunch of sameness. But understand the importance of hearing diverse opinions, diverse ways to do it. Like, as we started working on healthcare reform, we learned that there are a lot of ways to finance this whole thing. We need to learn it all. We learned that we don't know the terms. We don't know what that means. That was the purpose of the webinars that we had. We had to talk about what the single payer means. What does the insurance coverage mean? A lot of things. Don't assume that the public knows, because a lot of us, it's so complex and it's so scary until people are not dealing. And then they asked the question. They said, Americans are satisfied with their health care. Well, we might be satisfied with the care we are getting, but we're very dissatisfied with the system of delivery, which is never the question that's asked. You know, so you think, oh, well, everybody's all satisfied, so we don't need to worry about this. But be sure and bring in diverse voices. Also, think about conducting town meetings. Town meetings are a real good way to get people to come and open up and talk and make it spicy. You know, like I've done about 5 or 6 of them, and I bring in a speaker like Dr. Jocelyn Elders, because, you know, she comes in and she tells it just the way it is, and she's also a tremendous draw, and there are people in your communities. But also, I also include people from Physicians for a National Health Plan. At one town meeting in Gainesville, Florida, I had the insurance people there. There were people outside walking around with signs. There were the woman from the insurance company got so intimidated because one group had buttons on insurance no. And I mean, but you know, all of it made for a very lively discussion. There were CEOs from the local hospital, and out of that came a group called Healthcare for All, and they were able to save Alachua General Hospital from being closed. Alachua General Hospital served the black and brown people in Gainesville, and they didn't have any plans for Alachua General past 2008. And so together with the coalition that was formed from this meeting where people were yelling and screaming, and I was getting a little nervous all back, but something came out of it. That's the kind of energy that we need. So be your best creative selves, because you have to spice this thing up in order to get people to come and join you. Also, invite public officials, the elected officials. They need to be there not to talk, but they need to be there to listen so that they can learn what people feel. And also, one of the things we did that was kind of quite by accident, the way we did our organizing is we asked different organizations to co-sponsor. And then the only thing that they needed to do was co-sponsor, and now we have the internet, and almost most of the organizations have all their membership online. And so we could send out invitations online. We didn't have to do postage, and we reached so many people. And in Gainesville, we had co-sponsors of people from the League of Women Voters to the NAACP. They were among the 40. So it made for a really nice audience. That's something that you can do, that you can work on, that you can start. The most important thing is to do something. And when you put together your program, put a glossary of terms in there and speak to them. Because, you know, people will look at a program and sometimes they don't look past the program. You know, turn to the glossary. We have terms in there. We want you to learn these words so when you hear them, you can talk about it. You can also tell people to find out what bills are pending that deal with health care reform. You can advise them. You can't tell them what to vote for, but I mean, you know what to do. But at least they need to be acquainted to know that these are the things that's pending. And now it's during an election year, and everybody got a health plan. Most of them sound sort of like Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, November 15th, everybody's supposed to be signed up, and that ain't happening. I'm just telling you, that is just not going to happen. People are not going to be signed up. People are still confused about it. But what they're using is the big stick. Now, people don't have money to sign, because we're talking about the working poor here, you know, which I think is pretty much an oxymoron. But people don't have money, and if they don't sign up, how are they going to be penalized? Through taxes. So, you know, it's like you're going to pay, you're going to make, you know, so it's still, they still got a lot of bugs that they have to work out there. But pay attention to the candidates and ask them, go confront them, talk to their people, and ask them about what are they doing about women's health. What are they doing about abortion? What are they doing? And say the words. And don't let them just get away by saying reproductive health care. Well, you know, that could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. You know, be bold and say it, because these are services that we need. And they are not backing off from what they're saying. So we don't need to back off of what we're saying. And we really need to be in their faces. And this is our time. Go back to the old organizing, having people go in and talk to folks. Go in and bring them on the hill. Go up and talk about how we want women's health issues, totally comprehensive women's health care, to be covered in health care reform. Because when you go in there, they tell you, well, we don't have people that look like you coming in here talking. So take some of the people who look like me, some of the people, some of the Latinos, get some diverse group and go in there. And that blows their mind, because it shows that we are coming together in our diversity. Always talk, have them talk about, and when you talk about health, put people in the center. A lot of people put money in the center. I don't want money in the center. You know, we want people in the center. We see money being spent all over this country for a whole bunch of things that we don't agree with. So it's not that there's not money there. It's just that there's not money there for us. But we need to bring this back and have people understand that health is a human right, and that we are humans and we deserve to have the best health care. We have a real good medical system, but they're absolutely poor on delivery, as many of you know. And of course, insist on the quality of care, demand equal access for everybody, demand that the services not only are accessible but available, and that they're culturally in tune with what people need and what our needs are. They're culturally relevant. View Sicko. It will be in DVD. It's coming out next week. on DVD. It stayed in the theaters about 15 minutes. So now that gives us the opportunity to get it, to bring it. It's very good. It raises very good questions and issues. However, they're promoting it as being a comedy, you know, which I think that's interesting. That maybe, I hope that's just marketing, because it left me feeling very serious. You do laugh, I'm not saying that, but this is a very serious issue. This is probably one of the most serious issues that we are facing. We need to complete the unfinished revolution that was started by President Roosevelt. Remember, he was polio victim, so he understood the need for health care and started the ball to rolling, and they saw the sold out on a lot of things. And know that we don't have, as Martha Livingston said, we don't have the biggest bullhorn in this fight. And we're up against corporations that have tons of money that can just put a spin on any little thing and change it around. We saw what they did to Hillary Clinton's attempts several years ago with health care. They just spun that all crazy, and people just back off. And we just got to stop being so gullible and do our own thinking. That's why when you get in the presence of other people and you talk together, you gain strength, and you can see and pick apart those approaches that are keeping us in the same place. So that's part of what I encourage you to do. We're having a conference April 17th and 18th at Simmons College. Please mark your calendars. Plan to attend. Oh, yeah, we've passed around some save the date cards. If you don't have enough, stop by booth 213. There's some there. And we hope that you will attend. Jocelyn Ellis will be one of the people there, because she's really got this healthcare thing down, and she speaks with such a wonderful, forceful, honest way. And we're working on the rest of the program, but we want you to join us. Another strategy that we have used, we're putting together what do women need. And so what we're doing is doing a series of small group discussions with women. We've been doing some with, help me out here. Lois been doing a lot of them. Help me out with the groups. I'll tell about the groups we're doing up in Boston.
Okay. In New York, we've done conversations with Southeast Asian women, including victims of domestic violence, who've talked about things like their need for dental care after being punched by their husbands. We've talked with labor support doulas and midwives and nurses about the needs of women for childbearing options. We've had meetings with young moms in the Washington Heights area talking about their need for coverage. Also, young men and women who are interns with the NARAL project. I see Myra Batchelor there. Thank you for helping us out with that. And, two meetings with older women. One with a very diverse group of older women at a senior citizen center in Mount Vernon, who had a lot to say about their families, not only about their own health care, but they were worried about their daughters and their sons and their grandchildren. And we talked with folks who are volunteers on the helpline of the Medicare Rights Center about the kind of questions they get in. So we're trying to get the full range of interest.
That's good. And Boston, we'll start next week. We're meeting with healthcare providers to find out what they need. See, this is a situation where no one is happy. Everybody is unhappy with what's happening. Just keep that in the back of your mind. They're all unhappy. And we'll be meeting with a lot of immigrant women, women from Afro-Caribbean women, women from Ethiopia. We'll be meeting with Brazilian women, and all who are there to talk about their needs. We did one really incredible meeting with young women, teens, who raised issues that somebody like me really don't know much about and think about. They talked about all of the piercing and how that is such negative, self-abusive behavior. And they also talked about cutting, that these services should be. And they also talked freely about drug addiction services that need to be readily available, like a million times more than what we have. And what I really liked about these young women, there was a real integration of all different kinds of health care. It wasn't just physical. It was also the mental, and it was also the spiritual. They already got it. They got it that all of this exists inside of us. So what we want to have by the time of the conference is a real laundry list of things that women need in healthcare that these people who are already meeting, they don't even have and they don't care about. But we want to amass a foundation of us who can raise our voices, who can bogart our way into the table. We don't want to sit at the table silent. We don't want to be told to just wait. You know, we don't want to wait. Wait for what? Nobody else is waiting. Why do we need to wait? But we need to have you all behind us. We need to have your voices to make it heard. The second thing I want you to do after you look at SICKO is to go back home and organize. It'll give you a lot of good ideas. And there's a lot you can do. If you work with people in churches, one of the things that worked very well for me over the years in organizing is first go and talk to the first ladies. The first ladies are the wives of the ministers. They are the ones that get the stuff done. They are your power brokers. They will tell you who can do this, who can do that, who can do this. That's a very good organizing strategy. And one of the last things that we're going to do in Boston, separate from the conference, is we're going to convene a town meeting called Commonwealth Care. How is it working for you? You know, like Dr. Phil, how is that working for you? We're going to say, how is that working for you? And I met with Dr. Judy Ann Bigby, who is the Secretary of Health, and also the Boston Health Commission, and asked them to support us, not only in words and deeds and all, but also financially, because they need to know what the people in Massachusetts are saying about Commonwealth Care. And to my delight, they both agreed and say we want to know about it, and they also coming forth to help us make this town meeting happen. So there's a lot we can do. And remember that you got to get active, because if you are not at the table, then you're probably on the menu. I thank you.